Welcome to Value Through Vulnerability. This is a podcast dedicated to putting the human back into humanity, and I'm your host, Gary Turner. I'm also the founder of Hexo Change, and Hexo Change is a transformational change practice dedicated to helping you connect to yourself, to others, and to systems at large in a more meaningful way, thus helping us turn around our workplace and planetary challenges and accelerating how alive we all feel in every aspect of our lives. This track is called Kaleidoscope and was created for me personally and for Hexo Change by Peter Griffiths, one half of the amazing Mind Takeaway. I hope you enjoy this exploration and please do share it on your social platforms so we can bring more humanity to more people. Hope to speak to you soon. Welcome to Value Through Vulnerability. This is a podcast dedicated to putting the human back into humanity. And we are boosted by Humans First. And we have founder of Humans First, Mike Vacanti, with us today. And two very awesome humans who, the first time we've ever had siblings on at the same time. Pretty sure there'll be no fighting. So we've got Imran Rahman, who is founder of Kokoro, which does a lot of work around helping develop high-performing teams via technology. And we have Najib Rahman as well, who works as a data strategy lead for Pharma Trust, and which is basically quite blockchain derived, which is really interesting. So could I ask you both just to take a couple of minutes just to introduce yourselves, and what are you passionate about right now? Maybe we can start with you, Naj, that'd be great.
So I've been in the healthcare space for pretty much most of my working career, but initially for a rather big pharmaceutical, working in data analytics. And then a few years back, I took the leap, sort of investigating new technologies, trying to understand how that can interface, make lives better for humans, ultimately, into the blockchain space. And supply logistics operations is something I'm quite passionate about. Having seen some of the challenges, having operated in a global function with drug distribution across the planet, where we were seeing what I sort of experienced firsthand, some of the challenges that now quite literally a biological virus has disrupted and shown us where some of our shortcomings are. We're in a situation where those are now manifest to pretty much everybody. Having spoken about them for a long time and said it's hurting some of the poorest people on the planet, we need to do something about this. We're now experiencing it almost first time for ourselves here in developed markets. And I want to make sure that we create technologies that support the people. Ultimately, it's about making sure we get the behaviors from the people that will actually make this place and this world a better place for all us to serve. So yeah, that's what I'm passionate about.
Wow, what an intro. Incredible. Follow that one, Imran.
I'm the younger brother, so I don't think I can keep to that. For me, one of the thing has always been when coaching became one of the most dynamic tools available to HR and to organizations to help individuals, groups, teams, and the organization to move, I was in it. I got myself mentors. Something I think Naj and me have in common in our family is we've been accompanied through our lives, whether it was religious leaders, there was always somebody there accompanying us, helping us to move and improve. And I think that is what then stuck with me in the end through the mentors and the people around me. I became a coach and have been for over 10,000 hours now in over 70 countries. One of the things along the ways is the teams I had or the teams I was part of, we were always measured through engagement surveys or some sort of survey tool. And it was a piece of theater, really, because everything built up towards it, everything that happened in it and afterwards was all a piece of theater you played to. It was almost like people... And I thought, this is not how we work. All of us, you know, we have our children or we know children, and you go for a walk with a child, a five-year-old, and if they're hungry, you can't wait and tell them, look, in 3 months, we're going to have a survey and you can tell me you're hungry. And then we can deal with it. Or we do not, as parents, the day before Christmas, come into the living room, sit down, and our children are sitting there and saying, okay, dad, mom, so how's the year been for you? You don't get a yearly appraisal from your kids. Everybody gives you feedback there and then. And that was one of the things that really got me. It was like, you know, how do you create something that is moving continuously and giving you, not necessarily feedback, but giving you the whole idea of an experience continuously and showing this is what you're making me feel like. And on that data, I could make decisions. On that, I could find out what I need to do next. What structures do I need to change? How do I need to make my structures more dynamic to serve the people that are delivering or working? And that is the passion that grew and grew and grew. And the meetings me or Najib, Shahzad and myself would have every bi-week in Vienna slowly led to a tool being created on paper. I think we had a number of iterations through our bi-weekly calls. And it still remains a strong passion today. I'm a big fan of humans. I think the tools and the environments we create around them are not serving them. And I'm passionate about that and making those environments move. I don't fix people anymore. I fix environments. That's what I do. That's my passion, fixing environments so people can be people and they can become who they need to become.
It's so powerful straight away, Mike. I can see you're like, Mike and I look at each other's going like, this is epic. Because what you've both demonstrated for me straight away is I think we forget in the sort of tech seduction that the technology has been developed by humans for humans to thrive. But it feels like at times, look at my work organization, you get a top-down enforcement of Salesforce and everybody like goes off with stress for the next 6 months because they've been no part of the process. And I just love how you're both coming from a really purposeful, want to make a difference via the tech that you're using. And I think that's really interesting. What's coming up for you, Mike, as you listen to the introductions of these guys?
Well, the alignment obviously is huge, right? And to hear the experience and the diligence in the pursuit down those very real paths that are impacting lives is truly inspiring for me. To hear your thought and your belief around that, but then backed up by the experience and the action and the richness that you're bringing to the world, because it's creating change. And that change is the belief in what we accept. So do we accept those processes that we've become brilliant at, right? Over these last 100 years, humans are amazing. I mean, the systems and processes and orchestration that we've created is phenomenal. But it's not the reality until it's adopted. And we've become more reliant on the tools than the people that are using the tools. And that's what resonated most from both of you is, when we create these more powerful tools, or we envision what that next great tool will be, let's remember to train the people to use the tool properly. And that's what resonated with me as I was listening to both. And I'm excited to explore even further.
Yeah, I don't know, that kicks off a thought in my head. You just kicked off the thought about the data citizen for me. You know, L&D's role, our roles as companions, our roles, and I find companion is the leader today. And I find today more and more, one of the things I continuously do is show how to interpret data in living systems. So as a system moves and evolves, is how do you get that data? How do you read it? And how do you put that into action? And one of the biggest sort of things I keep seeing humans do is they look at the data and try to pull the reality out of the data they're looking at, where very often you have to look at the reality you're in and say, do I want this reality? If this reality is fine and the data is showing it is what you've got, then you don't need to change anything. But if the reality you're in today is showing you, I don't know, we're not working as a team. I seem to be making all the decisions here. I shouldn't be. It should be us or the person who has the most data and the most information to make that decision. Looking at the data, it shows me that I am making the decisions, therefore I need to change something. So suddenly you start realizing you can read data in living systems completely differently. And I think that is what we need to move towards. I'm still finding that we're using data more like a dashboard. The car is going at 80 miles per hour. Therefore, yes, the speedometer is correct. I keep moving. Thank you. Those are the sort of things that fascinate me Yeah, so that's what you get. We get this whole idea of the data citizen really, really sounds, you know, resonates with me very, really strongly what you're saying there, Mike.
Well, I love that. And I want to go back on the real-time learning that Naj was talking about earlier. But along with that is we have this propensity to want to apply the math that we've learned. We've put together this understanding of, here is how it works. These are the best numbers. This is the best process. And your job is simply to apply that into a strategy. Don't divert, don't think, just perform all those tasks in that orchestration, in that order, in that time frame, and you'll get the results that we need. Instead of saying, what's possible? Instead of changing the math, we spend a whole lot of time whipping people into applying the math that already exists. And so I love that you're already expressing, let's explore beyond that paradigm, or that limiting belief is what it really is.
There is a reason why that's come about, though, Mike and Imran and Gary. I guess, should we be exploring also? I mean, we've all worked for big commercial entities, I'm assuming. I know certainly I have. And what drives the desire to hit those sort of metrics that are serving one purpose only. Often it's either to kind of manage a bottom line or a top line. And those that are sort of the diktats, as you say, coming up from up high, are often driven by an incentive that is perverse, where the human is forgotten. I mean, the fact that we're even talking about data, even data informed, and I know Imran was saying that data, data driven or data centric or data informed, we're still kind of buying into ourselves that narrative and that lexicon of those that have sort of been driven by, say, the Wall Street, the analysts, whoever it is, the shareholder driven systems that we're in. And there might be another story to be had maybe if you go to the East and say, for example, the way the Chinese, arguably you could say that's still a capitalist economy, albeit quite controlled. But with that, what I'm getting at here, I guess, is this idea that we, until we kind of start saying it's human informed, maybe, and human driven, that we recognize that really that's where we're going to make the center of it, because we're still talking about the lexicon was, I mean, I was thinking, was it S&P that are saying that the value of oil companies has gone from 80% of that to 6 or 7% now? Oil business is out, but data was the new oil, right? And that's what we were told. We kind of give it that sort of sense of the existing economic structure that we're based within or living within. And until we kind of move that, until there's a paradigm shift away from that, I'm struggling to see how all organizations will really make humans the center of the business. The rhetoric is great, but anyway, that's something that I'm struggling with.
Fascinating.
Love it.
It's fascinating, Ajay, because one of the things I've been looking at is this insights into action. So you've got data, and then I'm like thinking, well, how do I now, as you get the feedback loop back into the organization, you've got the data, is how do I start changing the organization so it becomes, it uses new words. And we know that part of transformation is it's a social process. And what I started realizing, working with teams across Europe, was that you have to start creating new platforms of participation. And as you opened up these new platforms of participation, the wording started, the change of the semantic we started to use started to change. And that's when I started realizing people started moving away and saying, look, there is more than one form of evidence. And there isn't just the evidence, which is hard numbers, which we don't want to ignore. It's good. It's okay. It's good evidence to have solid, hard numbers. But there are then two other forms of logic, which people keep on forgetting. That was this logic of, it always happens, like the sun goes up every day, then you know that is a truth. But there is one part of logic we do not use, and that is maybe one of the most powerful part of the human, and that is plausibility. In higher mathematics, plausibility has taken us to unknown territories. Einstein, all of them, used the concept of plausibility in mathematics. And I think that should be replaced, put into the hard, it's hard-based evidence. This whole idea of it will always happen, like the sun coming up every morning for the next 6 billion years, is evidence, because it always happens. And there's one other part which we need to bring into the social platform. And there's the whole idea of plausibility is just a strong feeling, but it's also evidence to show we need to go down that road. And people forget that. And it's something which drives a lot of high-level mathematics, Nash. It's an interesting place to explore.
Do you think that the coronavirus pandemic has given us that moment of pause to enable us to imagine what is possible?
Yes, I think you got a good point. Because you said the public somehow. So I sometimes find cities are more intelligent than governments. I find cities phenomenally intelligent. You walk You look at the government, and the government's struggling within itself. I mean, we know we have a political crisis. I don't want to now criticize people here. I wanted to say, look, political structures are struggling or are in crisis, or there's something happening, and they need to evolve. Something means that the next change is happening, or maybe the people who are currently in it are helping us change it to the next stage. But there is something in the public I keep seeing, which is phenomenal. And whether you look at Sweden, whether you look at the NHS and the people in the streets and the way they, there's something there, and there's an intelligence there. And I think sometimes there are, the leaders sometimes get themselves onto a moral high ground by no fault of their own. And they forget there is that there is a group of people outside in the mass who really do, you start behaving in a way, and you can look at them through observation and change. That does not mean you then give them, this is where it gets very tricky, is what do you allow these group of people to decide? I think that is where it gets very, very tricky. You know, like with Brexit, for example, you know, if you allow then the masses to take a vote on something which is highly complex, then where will it swing?
But there the question was binary, and I don't think anyone on either side of that debate, and forgive me, I don't want to go down a Brexit question. That thought of polarization is difficult for a community to answer, you know, a nation even in this case. And that you could, I think, maybe actually I'd be interested to see what Gary might think about this. I mean, you were quite forgiving in your language of the governments. You know, on other days I would probably be less so. Whether I'd be as forgiving in terms of what they're trying to achieve and what they're trying to do, I don't know. Today, I'm feeling generous, and I'd like to think that as individuals, I'd imagine most people in government are trying to do the right thing. It's as a collective where the machine of government sort of takes over. Now, whether you believe in big state, small state, whether you believe in highly controlled or libertarian views or whatever it is, I think the challenge you have there is that that disconnect between people and humans, and then having technology and governments and their processes forced upon them, which is what's happening right now, because, you know, we're being told today that everyone's going to have to use an app, a contact tracing app. It's questionable, some of the merits of it. I understand the sentiment, and I get why we want to do it, but I'm concerned that the driver there isn't necessarily about what's right for us as people, as humans, and thinking about what is the behavior. It's driven by an ulterior motive, whatever that might be, by government. But you know, once again, I'll be curious to see what everyone thinks on that one, because I'm feeling a bit cautious about some of that right now, but I can see where the sentiment's coming from at the same time.
I think it's really curious for me to come back on it first, actually, is that, so I can't believe I'm going to mention this twice in 2 days with Mike on recording podcast. But I watched something about, like, David Icke, the conspiracy theorist, talking.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a lot of, it's curious. You have to go into any of these conversations with an open mind. But we're talking about humanity now. At the end of a 3.25 hour fascinating exploration of all the stuff you really don't want to believe could be happening on the higher echelons, he finished it by saying it's about unconditional love. If we make decisions from a place of unconditional love and connection, like, which is a bit utopian, but like, that's his, like, basically saying, if we come from that place, like, we can make better decisions collectively. Like, and it was just a really bizarre place to get to after 3.25 hours of basically saying that, like, COVID isn't a real thing, climate change isn't real. Like, so you had all of these other, then finishing with, like, unconditional love. And I think Mike and I would sort of go that, well, yeah, like, if we can come from an empathy connection, like, what are we trying to build collectively standpoint, then everything is possible. Like, and I wonder if that is an aperture right now with everything slowing down, that pausality you're speaking about, Imran. Like, people are really soul searching at the moment around how do they want to show up, and what do they want the world to look like post crisis. So I'm really intrigued, like, where all this is going, to be honest.
You just triggered something in me that I didn't see I'm going to go look it up now. God bless David Icke. Mike, I don't know if you know who David Icke is. TV personality, sports broadcaster here in the UK, and now a maverick in every sense. What is it the Buddhists said about true love, deep love is deep listening, right? So this idea that if it's all about love and you know, love for humanity and love for our fellow man and woman, then the way you get to that is through deep listening. That was my understanding. Sorry, and forgive me for simplifying Buddhist philosophy and teaching, but maybe it can be. And maybe our technology doesn't do that. Maybe that's where the challenge is. As much as we a lot of technology feels to be a dicta. It's like, you will use this app because we're going to contact trace you. Yes, we've got rules and regulations in to protect you because we understand that you want to be protected because we are telling you want to be protected. It's not actually listening to us, though, is it? And you don't get that sense of we're being heard. And that, you know, binary polls of population, plebiscites or whatever, referendums, or whatever it might be. In all of that, I think the message that comes across is we as people aren't being listened to. And there's a sense that until you start creating technologies that connect with people, and if you want to understand behavior and understand people's behavior, then you've got to start listening to them. And that probably is true. So deep love, deep listening, I think are probably the flip sides of the same coin in many ways. Anyway, does that make sense? Am I sounding like David Icke now?
You know, it does make a lot of sense. And the, you know, the depth of the conversation is I think really relevant and important, because each of the four of us are coming at that view, that perspective from very different places. Even different countries, right? So I'm here in the United States, so I stay away from political conversations just because, to a large extent, I think they're kind of irrelevant. I think it is the sleight of hand that we're given, and we're not paying attention to the magic. And there is a distraction, and I see that, you know, very often in those forums, and we've talked about that, that like polarization, you talk about the polarization of, you know, votes, or, you know, here in the States, the clown show we have going on, right? We send 535 people, you know, out to be our government, and truly we're just electing, you know, actors in the clown show. They paint their face red or blue and they yell at each other, and they don't really do a lot more than that other than raise money for the parties that keep selecting them, which is their primary purpose. The polarization becomes the tool for distraction. It's the emotional warfare that is thrust upon the people to keep them from thinking, to keep them in conflict, and really to keep them from connecting with each other. So here we are sitting in three different countries, the four of us, and we can understand the governments that are operating around us in our physical environment or our societal structures. But we could probably solve many of those problems amongst us in a short period of time, inviting others in, where there's hundreds of people in a bureaucratic system that can't even get to a point of agreeing enough to write a paragraph on a paper to take a vote on. I think we've really limited our opportunity to advance and evolve and solve a lot of the problems. So with that, what I'll just say is I've always believed in people over institutions. I believe in each of you much more than whatever structural institution I'm sitting within. And with that trust and belief, I certainly do not trust them with the data of knowing each person I come into contact with. I say no. I'll turn my phone off.
Yeah. And you know what? I couldn't have put it better myself, because I know each and every day in my own local community, the difference between me and some of the institutions that I see around us, even here locally, but certainly nationally, is that, I'm knocking on my neighbor's door and just having a chat over the garden fence saying, milk, tea, coffee, what do you need today? We're popping into shops. And likewise, that just happening, that's happening so much more. And yeah, people are definitely, they're listening just through by observing, right? You can see what's happening in your street, in your local neighborhood. You know, I go for a run and you'll see what's happening the two streets down that I might not have done, you know, 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And I can sense, oh, do you know, I noticed something was happening around the corner. Is everybody okay? And word will get round. And it's amazing how suddenly people are becoming more connected. And if that can keep growing, and I know it sounds almost fanciful and fantastic, you know, fantastical, is that a word? I don't know. I'll have that word today. In terms of my imagination. But you feel that if that can grow, then it could become something much bigger. And if that sense of community, and I, you know, actually coming back to the technology and the premise that we're starting off, we're actually in a weird sort of way, Zoom or whatever we're using today, Google or whatever, these technologies to connect people, I think that word, this is a way for us to disseminate that sense, right? Of that feeling that we're not alone. It's not just happening in my community here today. Because I can now tell you on the other side of the pond, or I can tell my brother in Vienna or Gary down on the South Coast that this is happening to all of us. And that word, the more this gets out, I think surely it, this sense that we are listening to ourselves and listening to our local communities, it's not just a community here. It's global, but global and globalized in a way that we've not understood. Globalization before was about driving efficiencies to the point where, you know, we didn't have resilience in our systems, where the kind of intersection between resilience and driving for lower cost meant that we were ignoring the damage we were potentially doing to our global communities or to our communities locally as well as nationally as well as globally. So yeah, I just do feel that this is a, I know I don't want people to kind of get the wrong idea, but I do think there's a magic about what, you know, going back to the word that you used, about what's happening today right now.
I want to add another thing to that, the application, because is the word control. So one thing that I love about digital technologies is the fact that they create transparency in any sort of system. If you digitalize something, it will create transparency. Like the book created knowledge on shelves and helped all of the global world to speed up innovation. Digitalization is now just creating transparency. Now, the app for me, if it's used to create transparency, to provide data for everybody, if there was just a web page which was continuously updating so everybody could look at it and see, look, what's going on in my country locally and far, you know, across maybe all the countries of Europe, then you'll be creating transparency, and on that people can make decisions. We're doing is this app is almost like it's a control mechanism, and it comes across as control because they built the technology based on the foundation of I need to control this. I need to control something, and you don't. If it was created through, you know, the whole idea of design by privacy, you know, and the fact that digitalization creates transparency, then you would create a tool that could actually provide data for everybody. So like I sit here in Vienna and we've done not a bad job at it, but there is this discussion going on currently, and a healthy discussion around, did we use our constitutional structures well? Did we use the way we make law well? The way we set this up, did we use a decree? Because after the Second World War in Austria, we had created a method with the help of the Americans and the people that got us up and going again after the Second World War to create a good constitutional process to create law. But we didn't use that road. We didn't use that path to create the law in Austria as we went into lockdown. And the app we got was based upon that decree. It was trying to control people. And it flopped. It flopped miserably. Cost 2 million euros and it fell to pieces. And I think that word you've got to add into it is it, if you're creating transparency, if you get out of digitalization's way and allow it to create transparency, people will make great decisions based on it. But it brings something which is emergent with it, governments to be vulnerable and say, look, I have trust in my people. And secondly, once you've got the vulnerability, then trust can emerge through a community, and this community can strengthen through that.
How many governments have actually said, do you know what? Some governments are beginning to say that, you know, hands up, I think we got this wrong. You know, there are things that actually there is some of that rhetoric coming through. I think certainly I've seen it in the UK with one or two of the ministers saying that now. But I think there is an interesting piece here for us. And I think if 50-60% of it can be done locally and managed, maybe we don't even need technology, digital technology in the way that we know it now. To support it, we could do that just through voice of mouth, the old-fashioned way, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's digital, right? We're using hands, fingers, mouths, you know, it's our but maybe there are some things that do need to happen. And, you know, from your perspectives, guys, what about the stuff that, you know, if we, maybe when we get the kind of, you know, there are a lot of people that are very dismissive of the anti-vaxxers, and it's very sort of, you know, from the scientific community, it's like, oh, these crazy nut jobs that are trying to kind of say we shouldn't vaccinate people and don't do this and what have you. But it goes back to the fact that because we're not getting information across, maybe those that are trying to create the capability for us to vaccinate aren't enabling others to understand, so that at the same time, not listening to those that are out there worrying about the concerns about what's happening with this virus. There are some things that I'm trying to say probably do need to be done through larger organizations, more structured sort of processes. And maybe some of what our conversation is trying to understand, how do we do that where we can still get that message across that we have heard you, we are listening, we're doing the deep listening that enables us to connect with you, the love and so on, because we understand there's a worry, there's a behavior that we want you to kind of be able to do to get on with life, whatever it might be. But we do need to kind of create a vaccine or a drug or a therapy or a treatment that might actually enable us to get back to a place, or maybe not back to the place where we were, but to a new place. Let's just say whatever that new place might look like. How do we do that? How do we kind of get that? Because I don't think, I don't know, do we want to get rid of big organizations and structures, be it government or companies or whatever? Or are we trying to say you need to change in a way that actually starts to listen and listen in a deep way? And I keep saying that.
I love this, Nadj. I think what I would like to just put into this. So what's coming up for me as you both speak is people deep in technology, which is really important as part of our theme for today's chat, is what is the intent of even creating the technology? Is it creation, as you said, Imran, to free and to be transparent and to give everybody something? Or is it to control? And I see the parallel, like, organizations quite close to me and others that I know are introducing technology to control. So they get transparency on the numbers and then to say, you need to do this amount of visits, you need to see this amount of contacts. So technology used badly is actually just another way of controlling like they did in the past. So I think there's something really curious for me. And it just came up to me as you were both speaking around, what are we doing around thinking, like critical thinking around why is technology being used?
I've taken it one step further, and people have asked me and I've given them straight up answers to it and said, look, your job as a leader today is to create structures so understanding can happen. So you understand what understanding is, okay? Understanding is a search for certainty. So are you creating structures that help people understand and deal with their search for certainty? Because if they're not, they're uncertain. And if things are uncertain, people struggle. And when they then look at me, they said, Imran, but how do these structures look like? And I said, well, you've got another job on top of that as a leader tomorrow. You don't only have to, I mean, in the past, a structure would be good enough. I could come in and dictate a structure and say, okay, this is the way we do it. Step one, step two, step three, step four. Now follow it. Called Salesforce, in other words, if you want to call it that. That was the prescriptive sales processes. But as markets became saturated with products, sales processes became dynamic. Then we started realizing sales processes change and you get 100 use cases. If you've got a team of 800 salespeople globally, each sales team is bringing up multiple use cases, and they need to make decisions there and then in their space, in the country, in the city, at the customer's place, in the office, where there is €100,000, €150,000 budget to buy your product. So Salesforce fails miserably if it's prescriptive. So your job as a leader is to create robust as well as dynamic structures together at the same time. They've got to be robust, but they've got to be dynamic at the same time. Now, what sort of thinking do you need to, as a leader, to be able to do that? You can't do an MBA at Harvard or any other big, massive school. They don't serve you to be able to create that sort of thinking. What you have to do is go off and spend some time with a systemic thinker, maybe a physicist who's working with quantum theory and understands how systems theory works. Maybe you have to apply the laws of thermodynamics to human systems to be able to start creating new types of structures. And that is what people, leaders, are not able to do, because it's, you got to first get the abstraction in your head and then you got to apply it and make it work. And how do you create those dynamic, robust structures that would help understanding, which is in turn the search for certainty?
How do you do that? I would say, I love that, by the way. And I think just almost holding space so people can go back and think of what you had just said and then how we got to that place. I just think it's so wonderfully stated and important, because it really comes down to what are those belief systems that we have, right? And, you know, like I look at the work that each of you are doing separately. When we talk about blockchain, the possibilities there are still very early, right? I mean, people think blockchain is like, oh, that Bitcoin thing. It's like, no, yes, but no. That decentralization of information flow or transaction capturing is pretty amazing when you think that can go to all kinds of monetary systems. Decentralized money would be a very interesting change for even the government structures that we're talking about. When you look at, we can decentralize energy, that takes a huge control out of the hands of those controlling people. So now, because it does become possible to use technology for good in a shared sense that is not control driven, because it's decentralized, there is no owner, and now the reward is not perverse, as Naj had said earlier, right? That becomes interesting. And then, you know, the work that you're doing, Imran, with the measuring of different measures other than the current KPIs we're using, right? So the feeling, how do we measure feeling? How do we measure belief around those changes? Can go down to a smaller group of people, or a city view, or an individual view, regardless of geography. And I think that becomes really interesting. So consortiums of people that are not under the old structural rule, making decisions and determinations about shared values or shared information, data informed, as you had said, rather than data driven, with the incentives not being perverse. Like, we might be able to have a serum for this. We could perhaps have a vaccination. However, there's a lot of argument going on who gets to win that Nobel Prize for creating it, and whose ecosystem are they in? Whose partnership do they belong to? Where, you know what I mean? There's perverse measures at play here. And if we strip that away, would we move all of those scientists closer to a solution in a more rapid sense that would save or, you know, help more?
Mike, can I give you something? Because I mean, this is really interesting what you're saying, because I hear your words, and I get asked, Imran, I want to do this tomorrow. I want to walk out of your room or the conversation I've had with you into my team and do it tomorrow. And then people, I always get asked a number of questions. I get asked, Imran, what do high performance teams do differently? And I always have to say, they don't do things differently. None of them do differently. All teams do the same thing. High performance teams think differently. And secondly, they don't know who they are. They don't actually know they're high performing. And the second thing which I give them is then, so first of all, start thinking differently. But then they say, what do you mean by that? I said, okay, I'll give you a sentence. And I want you to walk away with that sentence, and I want you to start playing with it. And they say, what is it? So look, high performance is created through one simple question. And he goes, what feelings do you want to integrate into the structures of your team? Go away and answer that question. And once you've got the answers, build structures that create those feelings. So the question is, what feelings do you want to integrate into structures? So if I want to have a feeling of understanding, like you said, Naj, deep listening, so what structures will create that? And then create those structures and see if they work. So we start with this. The first question you've always asked yourself is, what feelings do I want to integrate into structures? And rather than, you see very often the conversation goes, oh, we could do it like this. I don't want the structure first. What feelings do I want to create with these structures versus the question you need to take? Now, that's how high performance happens. And when it does happen by accident, very often, in most cases, it is by accident in organizations around the world, because you see them in the edge lens of the organizations. We go, God, what are those guys doing? They're killing it. And then you realize, when you look very, very closely, they are very good at integrating feelings into the structures. And if the structure doesn't serve the feeling, they change the structure. And that's when people then say to me, come to me, you know, I really love this talk about values and thing, but it meant nothing to me as a leader because I couldn't take, when I went to a leadership program and they talked about, Imran, what are your values? And I said, well, how do I make them practical? I mean, let me give you a typical Indian value, seamlessness. Okay, Mike, get up tomorrow morning and integrate that into your team. The word seamlessness is a value. People struggle. It's really hard. And let alone was like respect, integrity. It's really hard to translate into actions. But what is a lot easier is that, what feeling do I want to create in this team? Well, the feeling that they're killing it or they're doing this. Well, what structures will serve you? Serve the team so they kill it.
I love that, because if we were to take, if we were to bring a group of people to seamless camp and teach them how to do that, we would have a series of three-legged races, right? Put your right leg and your left leg into a bag and run a race again. We'll be seamless.
You see what I mean? But it's one of those words. I mean, just, I mean, Anaj, I don't know what you think, but I mean, I always find the English word respect versus our Urdu word or Hindu word, izzat. It's like the book in English for respect is about istik. And yeah. The book in our culture for respect is about what it's about.
Yeah. What aspect of respect in Asian culture and society are you talking about? Because you never integrate it in. But no, that's a good point. That's a good point. And you're right about that, Mike. Do you know what? I might just do that for a bit of a giggle. So where are we landing then, guys? I'm kind of curious. I like where we're talking. The thing is, there's a poem, and I forget who wrote it now, but this idea of, the poem is All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, right? And I know there was the Adam Curtis documentary about the same. I don't know if you've watched it, I'd recommend it, but certainly the poem's really interesting. But are we saying that there's different ways? Because I think the poem itself was almost written, and forgive me if I get this wrong, but I get the sense that when the poem was written, it was almost like not a warning, but it was, there's a vision of what it could be. But we're describing a different vision, right? Or are we? I don't know. I'm just trying to get a sense of it.
I'll go back to one of the first sort of communication experts, or the first one was Marshall McLuhan, wasn't he? He was a Canadian. Early 1920s, 21, 22, 23. And back in 23, he wrote a lovely sentence that, you know, we are what we behold. We create the tools and the tools form us. That was 1923 he wrote that simple, like, couple of sentences. And I think that's what it's about is, remember, was it the late 90s or was it the early 90s when we had this death by PowerPoint? PowerPoint killed the presentation. Nobody was to blame for this. It was just that a tool started forming our behaviors.
Yeah.
Was it? Exactly. And I think that's what it's about. That very often, it's like if you take a tool like Kokoro, one of my main missions of Kokoro is to make the tool obsolete as quick as possible. Once we've captured data and we visualize it in the most beautiful way possible, between it visualizing something and the human conversation that begins, there should be no time at all. It should be, the tool should become obsolete as quick as possible.
Yeah.
Because then it has a function of support as a catalyst, as moving something, as to get something going. Getting the signal out of the noise for you to say so you know, okay, this is the next conversation I've got to have. And can I choose the next conversation I can have? Yes, I can. Let me choose it and have it. Because if I can do that, we get what we call summative data, and we can start creating robust dynamic structures to serve the future that is coming at us. And that is where I'm trying to head. And when you start getting into the nitty gritty, you start realizing one of the biggest challenges we have as individuals and as collective is this, once we do get insights, how do we turn them into action that serve us collectively? So we can get ourselves into a collective flow.
Isn't that the big, like, what a fascinating exploration. Like, we always don't know where we're going to go with these chats, but I hope you're still with us and you're enjoying it. But I think that choice thing though, Imran, for me is really, really interesting, because with choice comes accountability. We were speaking about this last week, and I think there's like a sort of accountability, like right now, I think part of what's going on is this, oh, I can be more. We collectively can be more. We can shift these beliefs. But do we want to? Like, and I think we're getting to like, I think part of right now is part of the whole, we and I can be so much more. I can make a difference bigger than myself. I can be part of something that makes a difference. But like, do I want to or not? Or do I just want to go back and retreat because it's much more comfortable and it's, so I'm just really intrigued by that pivot point right now.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think there's a bit of that in all of us, right? Isn't there? I mean, I know that, you know, I see Imran made the point about kids and the honesty of kids up front, right? Maybe it's just my kids, but I don't think so. I think talking to a few parents, I'm hearing the same sort of thing. You know, if the kids are feeling safe and comfortable at home, they're happy to connect with the world as and when it works for them, but they like the security of your home. I mean, I know my kids are really quite happy. You know, sometimes it's a struggle just to get them out the, into the backyard, into the garden. They're that comfortable just being in this space with us. Surprisingly so. I want them to be a little bit more rebellious, but maybe that is our natural. There is a default as humans that we, you know, obviously, I guess for tens of thousands of years, that's what we've always reverted back to. We need to find somewhere safe and secure. That fundamental feeling and emotional sort of security is foundational to us. And maybe just come back to the other point I was making about whether we're being watched by machines of loving grace. Maybe it is we're just being enabled by machines of loving grace that want to make us more human. That's what we want to get to, right? Maybe that's what we should write, the poem of tomorrow, as a counter to the one about being watched by machines of loving grace. Yeah, I think there's a bit of that in all of us, right? And I certainly feel it. I feel I've got quite used to being at home now. I mean, I'm almost wondering, and maybe the next step for us is now is how are you going to get me out of my house and back to kind of having face-to-face meetings? Because I'm actually quite cool with this. I'm enjoying it, and I like the fact that I'm in my home, and my kids are sitting next door doing their schoolwork, and you know, my wife's working in the other room next door, and so on, and then can kind of interface and interact. It seems cool, and then I've got my little neighbourly thing going on.
I want to take you back to what I think that's about, Naj, because once you create that sense of safety, that safe environment, and I think that's one of the issues of what schools are not able to live up to, then, you know, they're not listening to the children who are saying, look, create safe spaces for us and we'll gladly come to school and be inspired every day. But they don't. If you do have the once in a million head teacher who does a fantastic job in creating that environment, then kids love that school. And we're the same. We're no different. We're little children in our homes. And I think what happens is at home, you build what I call vertical relationships. The vertical relationships are always based on you're continuously encouraging each other. Yeah, you get angry, you have your little arguments about not putting the lid back on the milk and not putting it back in the fridge. But at the end of the day, every discussion at home is about encouraging each other to make it work and say, look, guys, if you do this, I do this, and I do that, and you do that. Well, guys, you're really good at cutting the onions. You do that, and I'll do this, and we'll cook dinner, and we'll be done by 7, and at 8 we can watch Spider. But there's an encouragement towards the future. And these are, for me, vertical relationships. We continuously believe in safe spaces. And what we do then through things like Zoom and any sort of platform, you keep finding you can get directly to the point and get depth because you build an eye-to-eye relationship. And then you've got these relationships which organizational structures build and they're horizontal. And they get hidden by the word praise, and praise is an enemy because praise is the brother, the sister of punishment. It comes from a place of, look, I am better than you. I'm praising you because I've done this and I've done this better than you and now you're learning to become like me. And I think that is one of the things which I think safety creates is this idea of children.
Binary as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's very, very simple. Children feel encouraged at home. The reason they don't want to even go into the backyard is it's because within their home, they feel eye to eye with you and with each other. And in houses where it's not like that, then there is a horizontal relationship damaging the child very often.
I think you're right. There's something in that actually. And the thought had occurred to me that whole idea of, and forgive me, I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, obviously, but we create a personality for the rest of the world. And every time we step out of our front door, what used to step out of our front door to go to the office or wherever, school, you'd have another persona that you would adopt. And we all had personas. And it was that, particularly if you were spending most of your time at work, obviously, as many of us were, that sort of alternate persona was so much of a part of you, that constant struggle between what was going on at home and not having the ability to kind of boundary, because when you're in the office, you're in the office, and you're having to be that person all the time. But here at home, I can just switch off my computer, and at least I feel I've got better or more disciplined over the 6, 7, 8 weeks in terms of doing that. And I can go back to being the person I want to be, and going back to the emotional state that I want to be in, more importantly, more readily and easily with my family. In actual fact, I'd like to, you know, it'd be interesting to ask my kids, I haven't done this yet. There's a challenge for me at the end of this. Say, do they think I've changed as a parent, as a father, in the 6 to 8 weeks? And are they connecting with me in a different way to the way they were maybe only like a couple of months back? And I think that would be a really interesting question to ask my children this evening over dinner. Because, I think there is something of that. I mean, when I was talking to a friend of mine that suffers from mental health issues, and he was saying that actually it's quite easy for me to be this person at home because I'm not being forced to be somebody different every time I step out the front door, and I don't have to take my medication and my drugs to kind of make me the person I have to be for the rest of the world. I'm happy being at home. And that, you know, that I think there's a bit of that in all of us. You know, we know that mental health issues are so prevalent, and you know, 1 in 4 of us in our lifetimes will probably suffer from some degree of mental health issues. But it's the fact that we've not listened to any of that, and we've not addressed that in the workplace, in the wider society, and so on. And that's the shortcoming and failing. And I think maybe, I don't know. It's just interesting you said that, because I'm just thinking about this. I'm going to ask him tonight. There you go. There's another angle there that I hadn't really thought about until now.
You could role model vulnerability even more. The name of this podcast. Go and get them now, lad.
Do you know what? I can hear them saying something out there. They're listening. They're saying something about, is Dad finished yet?
we're going to look to wrap up in the next 5 minutes or so.
No. There's no rush.
I would love. Like, it's been such a. Just an exploration, and I really hope, like, just totally quite unlike most of the other podcasts, which I'd expect with you two on here, to be honest, but in a really, really, I think, in a very fit for our time. I think we've really all come from this from our hearts, it's what's on our mind. And I think I felt being vulnerable at this point, like, is it quite in the theme of the podcast? Like, that I've almost boxed it in my own head at points during the conversation and going, it's fine, because this is where we are in the moment, human beings, and this is on our heart and mind. So I've been learning through this very conversation around that whole letting go thing, of that identity thing you spoke to now, just like, actually, what does the podcast need to look like? What does our job role need to look like? What does our work role need to look like? And I've been experiencing that real time through this conversation. I just find it so fascinating.
Likewise. No, it is. It's every time you have these conversations, your eyes open up to something different, an angle that you hadn't thought about. So I think it's brilliant. I think more of this needs to be done. Even if we touch a small part of whoever's out there listening to this, I think it'll be fantastic. And if it can open them up to have these conversations with their own families, their friends, their communities, I think it's a great thing. Surely that's the only way we're going to make change happen. For the better, of course.
Think of that, how many paradigms we've pushed against. And if that's not vulnerability, I mean, seriously, it's the exploration of what works. Did we choose, or do we just follow along to what's been handed to us? You know, do we have the ability to explore and change our thinking around, you know, the actions or the beliefs we encourage or act upon next? I think there's so much vulnerability in here, Gary, because it's not really a no better. It's a thinking. And one of the things that was a huge takeaway for me is understanding the knowledge or experience. Is it empirical knowledge because it was written and it was intellectualized and we now believe that because it was handed down as wisdom or taught to us or it's in our biological DNA? Or is it something we're experiencing and therefore I know it? And in there is this richness of human experience. There isn't any right, but it is all knowledge. And how do we share that experiential knowledge with each other? That's what was moving, you know, through me through all of this. And that's a vulnerable feeling.
Absolutely. That's amazing what you've just said, because that resonates totally with what I've felt as well. Absolutely. 100%. And I think just knowing that, hey, I will be wrong. I'm going to, you know, there have been moments where I've got it absolutely horrendously wrong, even in the last few weeks since I've been at home. But the fact that I can sit here and say that to my kids and to you and to the wider audience, whoever's going to listen to this, I know that that experience will also contribute to the learning of society. And we should embrace it. We should absolutely say, do you know what? There's no right or wrong. As you said, there's no right or wrong. And being okay is absolutely fine in all of this. You know, you don't have to be the best mum and dad in the world. Just make sure that you show your children that you are capable of learning from every opportunity that you have with them, because that's the most precious thing as far as I'm concerned here right now. Anyway, yeah, that's I think you're absolutely right, Mike. That's, I couldn't have said it better.
I've got like two sentences in my head at the moment that really like sort of like trying to just the conversation we had the last sort of 15 minutes, and it's like it's almost like I don't know, see if I can say it now, because like it's emerging as we speak, and it's this whole idea that everything we talked about is really just, you know, if I was going to summarize into two sentences, it's almost like, you know, we are not rational first and we emotionalize our rational thought. We are emotional first and then we rationalize our emotional thought. And I think that is what we've been doing here. We've been saying, look, these are the feelings I have, whether I'm a good dad or a bad dad. I'm in the process with my kids of learning how to get out the way, remove myself from as they evolve and grow. You know, they won't burn, they won't fall over and hurt themselves anymore. They can walk, they can talk, they can do their things, and then moving on to becoming beautiful adults. And I have to have this feeling of letting go, and feeling of letting those, you know, it's an emotional feeling of letting your children go into the big wild world. And I can rationalize that for me in my context to help me be emotionally stronger in letting them go. And I think that's what's really, really like sounded strongly and resonated with me over the last sort of 50 minutes, 51 point.
I am 60 seconds. Buzzing. Honestly, I'll tell you why I'm buzzing, right? Because I just think what I hope people have experienced through us today and with us, and thank you for joining us, is just we can all have these conversations with anybody that doesn't look like us, sound like us, come from a completely different background to us. Like, just in, so that's my hope for like this. This is a great example of a conversation. Like, have the conversation, like, go out and find someone that doesn't look like you, have a conversation with them. It doesn't have to be deep and meaningful per se, but just engage. Like, so I think that's the number one biggest barrier for me, is that fear to engage with somebody that doesn't think or sound like us. And I think that's the opportunity right now.
Oh, I think you're right.
I hope people feel that. I hope people feel that from our conversation today.
Absolutely. And you know what, just thinking, just adding to that point, that it's that the he or she that doesn't look like you, I know we're four men on this call right now, and honestly, I sometimes feel that at times I have these sort of conversations with men I could probably count on one hand. And I just hope, you know, for me as men making it, because hey, look, sisters and women out there, they are way better than this than us. And I think that's something probably for another time, a conversation we need to have, the fact that it's four blokes around this table, this virtual table, having this conversation, I think is amazing. Because to be honest, yeah, I don't have these conversations very often. So yes, hats off to you all. Thank you. I can only extend my gratitude. Great big hug out there. Virtual hug to you all for doing it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Nazman. Thank you, bro.
Well, I'd love for the people to know how to get hold of you. So what's the best contact medium? Because people are going to want to carry on this chat with you guys, I'm sure. So Imran, can we start with you? What's the best way for people to...
Well, through LinkedIn. First name's Imran, surname's Rahman, R-E-H-M-A-N. That's connect on LinkedIn and send me a message on LinkedIn. Otherwise, you can go to www.bkokoro, B as in to be or not to be, and Kokoro is K-O-K-O-R-O.com, and connect by that. You'll find me on the Teams page there. Otherwise, get in touch with Gary or Mike through your wonderful work, and I'm sure you'll find me. I'm out there. I'm still here, so you'll find me.
Okay, thank you, Imran. Same for yourself, please, Nat.
Yeah, guys, I mean, LinkedIn, as my brother said, Najib Reeman on LinkedIn. Sorry, confusing my email. And then it's najib.reeman@pharmatrust.com. So if you go to our website, you'll be able to contact me. And obviously through yourselves, Gary, Mike, please, you know, anyone that reaches out, then forward my details. They're more than welcome to reach out and connect, and happy to have these conversations one-to-one or in a group dynamic. Again, more than happy either way now.
Love it. And Mike, anything coming up for you before we head off?
Just gracious of both of you to go full into it and explore at all those depths from the business and the social and then right down into your homes. That was just tremendous giving, and I'm very grateful for both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Just, I'm blown away. Like, I always get blown away. I always have great chats, but like, yeah, you two are awesome. And thanks for what you're doing as well. Thanks for energy.
By the way, that was my wife just coming in, hiding a secret stash of chocolate she just bought by the way. I don't know if you saw her walk in behind me afterwards, but she was desperate to hide the chocolate before the kids stole all of it.
Possibly the perfect ending to this conversation. Thank you very much.
Exactly. Chocolate's a good way to end.
All the best.
Thank you.
Hi there, Gary Turner wrapping up this just beautiful conversation with Imran and Najib Reeman alongside co-host and founder of Humans First, Mike Vacanti. We just had a beautiful, wonderful exploration of our humanity, of technology, of culture, of listening. If I could be in this sort of conversation most of the time, I'd be a happy person until the day I left this planet. Just open-hearted, open-minded, curious exploration. No judgment, no fear, no worry about what someone else is thinking. Like, I just genuinely believe this is an incredible role model of the type of conversation that should be more widespread. And I think it will certainly help us solve our societal ills if we are able to lean in and hold these different views and experiences of other people without judging them. So the few things I'd like to leave you with as a wrap up is, when Nad shared, maybe we are being enabled by machines of loving grace that are enabling us to be more human. I just thought it's a really lovely reflection, because far too often technology is still the front end piece. People are still very much, you know, we must get the technology in, and then a load of humans end up being harmed, getting stressed along the way, rather than intentionally designing the system that allows technology to unleash human gifts. And I just think Naz spoke to that really, really well for me. I loved it when Imran shared that, I'm a big fan of humans. The tools and the environments that we create around them are not serving them. I don't fix people anymore. I fix environments so that people can become who they're meant to be. Just stunning. Technology as an enabler of our humanity. Again, critical, critical point. Yes, we do need technology. It does enable us to be more agile, to get more done when used well. But are people involved in the process? Do people understand what's expected of them with technology? Is the environment, and when you speak about environment, of course, I believe that if you're speaking to culture, is the cultural setup, is it safe for people to speak up? Is it safe for people to innovate and challenge the status quo? The people feel comfortable to take calculated risks. That environmental piece is so, so critical. Finally, Nad shared, people are listening through observation right now. I just think that's a really, really interesting reflection. And it makes me think about Oscar Trimboli. He joined me many, many podcasts back on the Value Through Vulnerability podcast. And one of his key elements of his listening model is that listening for what is unsaid. And I think this speaks to that. You know, people are listening through observing. You know, they're digesting and taking on board, you know, the pandemic pause we're all experiencing, what's going on with the race conversation at the moment. You know, people are listening through observing, but at some point we also then do need to take action. And I thank Imran and Nad for this amazing conversation with Mike and myself. I just want to let you know that there will be some truly human conversations. This is something that Mike and I are looking to set up more of. And it's not just in response to the recent
challenges around the race and Black Lives Matter conversation. That's been a huge, huge fuel for it. But we want to make sure these are ongoing, sustainable conversations where we share our lived experience. So regardless, regardless of the hue of your skin, we want to celebrate the differences. We want to celebrate the lived experience that we all have, regardless of the colour of our skin, where we come from and our background. But we want to do that in a really intentional, smaller, focused group way. So maximum of 5 people, minimum of 3, coming together again. So the first one will come out this Thursday, which is myself, Donna Jones, an incredible systems thinker and white woman. And we have an incredible human being, Raphael David, who's an ex-US customs expert, who is a Black male. And again, it's not about the colour of our skin that defines the conversation. But of course, the colour of our skin brings with it a different lived experience and potentially more barriers, as Raphael has experienced, than I would have done as a white male. And this is the conversation that we have, is how do we share experience, empathise, learn from one another, and then rebuild better going forward. And that's really the objective of the human conversations. If you're interested to be part of those human conversations, do follow me at Gary IP Catalyst, or you can email me gary@garyturner.life, and that's G-A-R-R-Y in Gary. And I'm particularly keen, as I realised over the weekend, that my network on LinkedIn and my wider network has far too few Black males within it. And again, it's not about quotas, it's not about numbers, it's about the lived experience. I am lacking severely understanding firsthand the lived experience of Black men. So I'm actively looking for more Black men, as well as other people in the network, but particularly for these conversations. If you are a Black male or you know someone that you feel would be interested to be part of an intentional, safe, exploratory conversation as we learn from one another's lived experience, please do let me know. So have a wonderful day and week ahead. Thanks so much for listening to this conversation. And until next time, be well, be safe, and take care. Really hoping that you enjoyed that exploration on the Value Through Vulnerability podcast. You can find out much more about Hexo Change at hexochangenow.com. That's hexochangenow.com. You can subscribe to a weekly newsletter at that website, which includes information about live stream conversations, further service offerings, blogs, but also our in-person events, of which we have multiple each year. So I really hope that you'll join us. Do connect with me, Gary Turner, on LinkedIn, and I really hope to hear from you soon.